And my name is Sophia Riddle, as was mentioned, and I work on our oil and gas EPI team. And I'm going to be speaking about the development of our fatalities and oil and gas database. So to put everything in context, I'm going to begin with a little bit of overview of the industry, including fatality trends. And then I'm going to spend the bulk of my presentation, and what I spend the bulk of my time on, is our fatalities and oil and gas database. And then finally, I'm just going to spend a couple of minutes on our other initiatives. So to begin, what you're looking at here is a chart of the active U.S. rotary rigs. And this is similar but a little different to what Marisa showed. Is this is an active rotary rig. So these are rigs that are currently drilling oil and gas wells, and that can be new wells or extensions of old wells. And the most what you can see here is that oil and gas activity is extremely volatile. It's up and it's down and it changes quickly. So from 2003 to 2013, the industry activity increased 71%, or the number of rotary rigs increased 71%, and the workforce doubled 2 times. But if you look today, the number of rotary rigs has significantly dropped off, and this really indicates that the industry as a whole is going to go, activity is going to decrease because if they're drilling new wells, then the operators, the drilling companies, and the service companies are all going to be busy. So with this decrease in rotary rig count, the industry activity is far down. And I also wanted to point out too that this is an average for 2015, and right now, so that's about above 1,000 rotary rigs. But if you look at it today, it's about 775. So the increases and the decreases are dramatic. But as the fatality rate is not following this trend. So as Marisa mentioned, in the beginning it did follow this trend, whereas the industry activity increased, the fatality rate increased as well. But over a longer period of time, this trend has changed and it's decreased significantly, 36%. So that's a really good thing, because new increases in industry activity has generally been characterized by new and inexperienced workforce and new companies entering the industry, maybe with less experience and less mature safety and health programs. So to see these changes, to see the fatality rate decrease despite these increases is a really good thing. And these, as you break it down by the different company types, these changes continue. So on the left here is the change in the fatality rate by each of the different company types, and on the right is the change in the workforce size. So these are mine, right? And I'm going to just give you a second to absorb this, because this is really a powerful graph. So you can see here that the operators decreased their fatality rate by 58%, but their workforce increased by 62%. And if you look at the support activities, it's even more dramatic. So they really increased. They more than doubled. And if you add in the 2014 data, it even surpasses 2.5 times their industry, their workforce grew. But their fatality rate decreased 33%. This is similar with the drilling operations, although the drilling companies are a much smaller workforce, and so they decreased 27%, but that decrease was not significant. And by the different event types, contact injuries, these are struck by and caught in types of injuries, and transportation fatal injuries decreased as well. But fall, slips, and trips increased, were the only event type to increase, but this increase was not significant. And again, this could be due to the small sample sizes. Marisa mentioned these are only about 7 to 8% of the fatalities, so they're a small proportion. So despite this improvement, oil and gas is still a high hazard industry, and it has a fatality rate 7 times that of general industry. So there's definitely more work to be done. And we want to see continued improvement, and so does our industry partners. So we strategized with our NOAA Council to figure out what more we could do. And from an EPI standpoint, one thing that the NOAA Council and we felt would be helpful is just to have more information about these fatalities, to go beyond what I've already talk about and go in depth into what's actually happening in that caused these fatal events. So we thought with more information, we could get a better understanding. We could put the pieces together and see here, as this red cog in the wheel is not moving, what's not working, and use that information to have an evidence-based interventions to try to improve the system. But the problem with this is that that more information that we really need to be able to do this is just not captured in available data sources. They just don't have enough specificity to really get to the level of detail that we would need. So we created the Fatalities in Oil and Gas Database, which is a new internal database to NIOSH that collects specific information about the oil and gas industry. And before I continue, I think it's important to mention that our goal with this database is not to necessarily collect we would like to collect as many fatalities as we can, but we're trying to provide details about these fatalities. So to get an actual count, your best resource is still BLS. So what does an oil and gas database specific to the oil and gas industry look like? Well, first, our inclusion criteria are those that are working in and doing activities for the oil and gas industry. So as you know, it is land-based, and as well there are offshore rigs, so we include fatalities from both these two different operations, as well as we include the common oil and gas NAICS codes. But there are also companies who do work in the oil and gas industry that may not be captured under these common oil and gas NAICS codes. So if we identify these fatalities, we'd like to include them. And these fatalities might be sand movers, so they bring the frac sand to the site, but they might be captured into a specialized freight NAICS code, but they are really doing a lot of work in oil and gas, and this might be the main part of their business. And then we collect motor vehicle incidents, as well as non-traditional commutes. So in this industry, workers are often traveling very far to their to where they work, and they might be traveling as a group. So our non-commutes include motor vehicle incidents where the workers are traveling more than 90 minutes or 50 miles one way as a group or as part of a paid transportation service, which is common. Sometimes they will have drivers drive them to and from sites. And then finally, because exposures in this industry we're still identifying and understanding the different types of exposures, may include cardiac events. We only focus on the upstream portion or the extraction portion, so midstream and downstream events are not included, and we only include fatal events. In terms of what we collect, we separate our variables into incident variables and worker variables. And these variables, we have variables that we collect on every incident. So if you look at the workers, we'll collect occupation on every worker that dies, their experience, their different OIX codes, and a number of other different things. But we also collect type-specific variables. So if the worker died in a fall, we'll collect additional variables, such as what was the fall height, or were they wearing a harness. Similarly, with incident variables, we have about 30 incident variables that we collect on every incident. And then we also have these type-specific variables. So if it was an offshore incident, we'll collect more information about those. We rely on a lot of different data sources, so we're trying to make sure that we can capture as many details as we can. And this requires a lot of different data sources. So our main one is OSHA. We do get some OSHA data. And then we rely on the media for identification, and then some other, we might be able to extract some more details. And then as needed, we'll order autopsy reports, crash reports. The Bureau of Safety and Environmental Enforcement heads up the offshore fatality investigations, so we collect data from them, as well as a number of other sources. But just like everything, we do have our limitations, and probably our biggest is our off-site motor vehicle incidents. These are really hard for us to identify and capture information on. But we are working with state partners because this is a large portion of the fatalities, as Marisa mentioned, and we want to try to get as much information about these incidents as possible, but this one will take us a little longer to get really structured in this database. And then we don't, similarly, we don't have a good way to capture work-related chronic illness. And what do we want to do with this? Well, we don't want to just get the data and keep it to ourselves. We want to get the data and then move it out to the people who will use it. So this is occupational safety and health professionals, other government agencies, as well as the workers. And each of these audiences will have different ways in which they receive information. So we'd like to include our FOG information in products that suit their needs. And we're happy that in just the short time that we've already seen impact from this. So as Marisa mentioned, there was the TAKE aging hazard alert, and this FOG data played an important role in this, because through FOG data, the 9 fatalities were identified. And these, and during the creation of this hazard alert, which included a lot of people, so over 75 individuals worked on the creation of this product, and they came from all different backgrounds: OSHA, NIOSH, industry, other trade groups. We have even like API, which has their own lobbying groups. There's a lot of different people who were involved in the creation of this, and getting this information out, it was important that it was accurate, and people did have concerns about whether if this could really cause, this type of issue could be cause death, and if we should put that out and put this on this hazard alert. And through FOG data, we were able to show these 9 deaths, put it on our website, and let everybody have the same information, and it ended up that people, while that issue was stalling the creation of this product, once we were able to put that FOG data out, I think people came to a consensus and this product started rolling again. So that was really good to see that we could use FOG data in this way. As Marisa mentioned, we did recently put our first publication from FOG data, a NIOSH publication. And this is describing fatalities for the first half of 2014. And we have it organized in narrative, so these go provide a short description of each fatality that happened that we identified. And then we also talk about the fatality characteristics in terms of how people are dying in the different event types and what type of industry sector, if they're an operator, drilling company, or something else. How members from each of those groups were dying. And then finally, we look at the industry activity. So similar to what I first presented, and we look at what the industry was doing for the first half of 2014 and how this relates to fatalities. And I encourage you to go and check this out if you have interest, because unfortunately, I don't have a lot of time to go into the details of what was in this report, but there's a lot in it. So on the horizon, we will be doing full year reports for every year, as well as some multi-year reports. And then we also want to use FOG data to produce special topic reports. So probably our next one plan will be fire and explosions associated with tanks. We'd like to do some H2S exposure to remind people that this is still an issue in the industry, and then dropped tubulars, meaning the drill string or the pipes that they actually drill into the ground. And then finally, we want to increase our partnerships to better capture fatalities and better capture information about these fatalities. So I'm gonna move on to our other initiatives, and I'm gonna begin with our transportation safety initiative. So as Marisa mentioned, this is a big issue in this industry, and even this graph down here, which shows the fatality rate in motor vehicle incidents, are quite high even compared in the oil and gas industry, are quite high even compared to other industries. So you can see on this green bar that that the oil and gas industry, that this is definitely a big issue. And I think one of our members of our NORA Council, who works for Helmer Campaign, he really put it simply that oil and gas is a transportation industry that just happens to produce oil and gas. And I think this really solidifies how you can look at transportation within this industry. So to that end, the NORA Oil and Gas Council Motor Vehicle Working Group was created, and it was created to prevent incidents like this here in the picture. And this van was carrying 7 oil field workers, and 3 of these oil field workers died in an incident. And in a crash where this van hit a school bus that was carrying children, and luckily none of the children were hurt, but 3 oil field workers died, and it is suspected that the driver was fatigued. There were no brake marks at the scene, and they hit this bus, and really, it was a really tragic incident, and this is what this group is trying to do. And it's similar to the NORA Council in terms of its members. It has operating, drilling, and servicing companies, insurance companies, trade association, academic partners that are all working to this end. And some of the outputs will be a driver fatigue fact sheets. We're working on that to prevent incidents like this one that I talked about, as well as YouTube video clips on seatbelt use and distracted driving. And finally, I want to talk about our oil and gas field survey. And this is the first survey of its kind, so that we know of its kind. And it really has broad objectives, which is just to identify the health and safety concerns of workers and then focus on motor vehicle incidents and the factors that contribute to them. We will be 500 oil and gas workers will be participating in the survey in 3 different states. And the content will have more general topics such as their demographics, their health and personal habits, their workplace and job characteristics, as well as the safety culture at their workplace. And then there will be some specific questions to our topics of concern, which you've heard a lot about these issues already today. So the tank gauging and sampling, driving behaviors, the chemical exposures, and then the respirable silica. And we hope the results from this survey will guide interventions and future research. So this is all I have for you today. I'd like to thank my co-authors, Kyla Retzer and Ryan Hill. And here's my contact information. I do this stuff all day, every day, and so I love to talk to you about any of your questions, things that piqued your interest, or any of your thoughts. And I'm gonna end with a list of resources of things that I talked about. So we have our Fatalities in Oil and Gas Fog website, the Oil and Gas Extraction Workers Mid-Year Report. And then third on the list is the our fog data that describes the inhalation fatalities that are involved with tank gauging and fluid transfer operations, the alert put out by the STEPS Council, and finally there was an MNWR that we put out that described the different types of fatalities that we see. Looking further into the information I described in the first part of my presentation.
Go ahead. Well, thank you, speakers, for today. We're going to open the floor for some questions.
Yeah, hi. Pardon me, I have questions at the end, but one of the earlier questions was that you described the process of steps. Partnership development like that. I noticed a lot of the work in Texas, California, and other places, and then a lot of the on-site explorations were, of course, around Colorado. You guys are based there, but also seemed to be the discussion was mostly about fracking operations. So that's really been the big thing recently. But I was wondering if this was that the STEPS companies are kind of like, some of them are pre-fracking. So is that because fracking is such a hot topic? I hope it's not just because you guys are studying places close to you in Denver, but also was the hazard characterization and risk characterization for the non-fracking oil extraction industry, do you consider that to be a more mature science than that kind of knowing? I'm just trying to figure out kind of the geographic location between like a lot of the STEPS partnership location operations and where the research.
Right. Well, I can speak to kind of some of the decision-making process for why.
Okay. You have that.
I won't stretch more.
Okay. Thank you.
Perfect. Okay. No.
So, just to recap, it sounded like your question was, you know, the difference between some of the sites that we visited for our exposure assessments versus where some of our partnerships were for the STEPS didn't seem to necessarily be completely in sync with one another. You know, a lot of the work that we've done for our exposure assessment sites, as I had mentioned previously, has been in partnership with a number of industry partners who have stepped up to the plate to say, yes, we'll work with you, we'll invite you to come out to our site visit, to our sites. It's actually taken us a long time to get to a good relationship with a lot of our industry partners where they feel comfortable having us out on the sites. We feel that we've collected a lot of good data and have provided good, solid science-based recommendations for that. That being said, a lot of the sites that we do go out and visit, you know, are locations where the companies that we visit, that we partner with, are located. And so, you know, as much of an attempt as we've made to try to diversify the locations, yes, you know, obviously Colorado is a place that we have done site visits, but not so much the fact that we are there, but it's just a hot industry there, and in the Dakotas as well, and we've tried to get down to Texas and the Marcellus Shale and the East and things like that. But, you know, I think that if we had something like a mechanism like right of entry, we would probably get a little bit of a broader ability to go and pick and choose where we're going. But that being said, like I said, that's kind of why the locations that we've done our hazard assessments and exposure assessments have been where they've been. I think that we are constantly working with our industry partners like STEPS, who are located across the country, to be able to get out to some of their sites. But even if we don't necessarily do exposure assessment data collection with at some of those locations, we are still in constant contact with a number of our STEPS partners. So, for example, these STEPS, regional STEPS networks, oftentimes have maybe monthly or bi-monthly meetings for their industry group in their region. So oftentimes we'll get invited to come and give presentations, to talk about some of the work that we've done, some of the recommendations that we've made. So even though we are not necessarily doing data collection in all of those STEPS locations, we do try to develop and cultivate the relationships with those individual regional STEPS locations so that we can at least, like I said, cultivate a relationship where it might end up that we can get invited to come out and do those site visits. So
just the last part of my question was actually asking you more from a technical standpoint, the risk hazard characterization of fracking operation versus, I'll just call it, pre-fracking oil extraction operation. That's what you guys described, but mostly focused on fracking. And has that sort of pre-fracking oil industry hazard characterization
Not really. You know, there's not a whole lot of data that is out there on a number of the different phases of the entire extraction and investigation process for oil and gas. You know, we basically, when we first started in the history of our oil and gas research, we started to look at some of the low-hanging fruit, to be quite honest. And so that was focusing on the silica question, which we looked at for several years. And then we moved into this issue about looking at VOC exposures during flowback. That's not to say necessarily that there aren't other opportunities that are ripe to explore the, you know, exposure characterization and hazard assessment in some of those other areas. And we very much would like to do some of that. We recognize that, for example, drilling operations, you know, before the fracking actually happens, is an area that has very little published data about it, about the potential exposures that happen. And so we very much have the desire to look at a lot of these other phases. It's just with the resources that we have now, we've kind of, like I said, I started to identify a couple of what we felt were some of the low-hanging fruits, and then hopefully we'll expand into some of those other operations.
Daycares that are close to these operations, you know, there's children playing, the The kinds of exposures that we were looking at, our farthest away samples were located probably 25 feet out from the sand mover itself, and by that distance we were already getting non-detectable levels of respirable crystalline silica. If you think about an expanding bubble, the dilution factor as the cloud, if you will, expands very quickly as you leave the source of the release, the concentration is dropping off. The risk of silicosis and lung cancer from exposures like these are something that emerges after a long period of time being exposed repeatedly at significant levels. So for exposures that might be a one-time thing or a very limited thing or an exposure at a very low level, there are probably not going to be any significant health effects.
Okay.